I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Authenticity is one of those qualities that is hard to define, but you know it when you see it or feel it. We're going to explore its meaning and its application to places today with James Gilmore and Scott Russell Sanders. Jim Gilmore is the man who, with his partner Joe Pine, introduced the idea of the experience economy. Now he believes the next big idea for business is authenticity, and he believes the same may be true for cities. From his vantage point as a writer and professor, Scott Russell Sanders has challenged the brand and bland direction of our communities and urges us to rediscover what makes each one special. We'll talk to Jim Gilmore and Scott Sanders about authentic places today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. James Gilmore is co-author of The Experience Economy, Work is Theater and Every Business a Stage, published by Harvard Business School Press and released in 11 languages. He and his partner Joe Pine run the business consultancy Strategic Horizons. Jim is a Batten Fellow at the Graduate School of Business Administration at the University of Virginia. With Joe Pine, you wrote the landmark book, The Experience Economy. Describe what you meant by the experience economy and its importance.
Well, there's nothing new about experiences. They've always been around. All of life is an experience. But the experience economy is the notion that experiences are a distinct form of economic output and that experiences are increasingly commodified. They're for sale. And the way we got to this whole subject is really to take a look back at economic history. You go back 200 years ago, nearly everybody lived or worked on farms extracting commodities, and the extraction of that commodities became the basis of the agrarian economy, the buying and selling of commodities in the marketplace. But we automated that work, and people left the farm to go into the factory, and the making of physical things, goods, became the basis of the industrial economy. But then we automated that work. People left the factory to go into the service sector. Services came to the fore as a new genre of economic output. And so with the experience economy, what we articulated was a point of view that experiences are, in fact, a distinct form of economic output, that experiences are as distinct in kind from services as services are from goods, and that increasingly what consumers desire are not goods or services, but rather experiences that engage them in a personal and a memorable way.
How are experiences different than services?
Well, it's a very good question because some folks simply want to say that experiences are a subset of services. Perhaps the best way to answer that is to go back to the distinction between goods and services. Economists speak of one of the key differentiators between goods and services is the fact that goods are tangible, services are intangible. There's an old economist joke. And in fact, it doesn't get much better than this for economist humor, by the way, that if you take an economic offering and if you drop it on your foot, if it hurts, it's a good. If it doesn't hurt, it's a service. They speak of the line of tangibility to differentiate a good from a service. Well, similarly, we can speak of the line of memorability, that experiences are more memorable. They're memorable events that unfold over a duration of time, whereas services are merely the intangible activities that are performed on behalf of another. So both services and experiences are intangible, but it's the memorability of the experience that really differentiates it from merely a service.
When you wrote your book, how did you expect organizations to use your ideas?
Well, I don't know if we quite knew what to expect, actually. We knew we were onto something new. It's sort of changed over time. I fully expected service companies would be the ones because they were most closely associated or could more easily move to experience would latch on the book. But as it turned out, at first, many goods companies, manufacturing companies latched onto the idea, I suspect because goods are increasingly more difficult to differentiate one from another. So a lot of initial work that surprised me was in making goods more experiential. So that's been one thing that I did not anticipate. I was really eager to see what new ventures would emerge, not just to incrementally improve existing businesses through experiences, but to see if the whole notion of experiences would help foster businesses that are altogether different, new to the world. And in fact, that has happened to such an extent that today I cannot even keep up, quite frankly, with the pace of innovation with regard to experiences.
And when you think about companies that have used your work in ways that pleased you, surprised you, were indeed memorable, which companies come to mind?
Well, I can start by naming some of the companies we've actually awarded with our Experience Stage of the Year Award. For example, the American Girl Place, founded by a former school teacher, Pleasant Roland, actually opened just prior to our book being published, just off of Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Now also has locations in New York and Southern California, and I think they've just recently announced they're coming to Dallas and to Atlanta. That comes to mind. The Geek Squad out of Minneapolis. At the time we wrote the book, we mentioned the Geek Squad several times. Wonderful example of staging an experience with all the costuming and the stagecraft of a 24-hour computer repair task force, not merely a computer repair service. At the time we wrote the book, Robert Stevens had no more than 24 special agents. Since then, they've been acquired by Best Buy, and there's now 13,000 costumed special agents in their geek mobiles, repairing computers and installing wireless networks and so forth. We just gave our most recent Experience Stage of the Year Award to a company called Seriality, where their theme is where every day is Saturday morning, and it's sort of the Starbucks of cereal, and they have just a handful of outlets today, but with plans for many more. And these are the kinds of experiences that I hoped would emerge, but again, could never anticipate the exact manifestations. But there's a couple of examples for you.
And you say, though, that now consumers are moving beyond experiences. They're tired of staged experiences, and they're looking for authenticity. And business, how can we tell the difference between a staged experience and authenticity?
Well, they're all staged. The word staged has some baggage with it, as does the notion that work is theater that we write about. It is de facto all staged. The work activity of experience is staging. It is stagecraft. Perhaps if you do it well, no one will call it staged. Just like all the work of services is you deliver a service. Back up a moment. You extract commodities. You make goods, you deliver services, you stage experiences. But if it gets viewed as staged, the negative connotation that you suggest, I think that does beg the question of authenticity. In fact, that is the subject of a book I've been working on now for a couple of years with my business partner, Joe Pine. And the notion is, in a world that is increasingly filled with staged experiences, with mediated experiences, with intentionally sensory experiences, it does lead, we think, to a new purchase criteria, a new consumer sensibility, and that increasingly the kinds of experiences that people desire are authentic, or ones that they perceive as authentic. But it's also true they increasingly desire authentic services, authentic goods, authentic commodities as well. And we see authenticity really coming to the fore in as significant a way as quality emerged with the service economy and as cost emerged with the industrial economy.
Then what constitutes, Jim, authenticity?
Well, I'll just do some definitional work that we believe, and I'm going to back up a second because we often think in these progressions that if a consumer buys on the basis of cost, they're buying because it's affordable. What mass production did is bring down the cost of goods so that nearly everybody could afford to have one of every product category they chose. And that purchase on the basis of cost really emerged with the rise of the industrial economy. When a consumer buys on the basis of quality, they're buying based on performance. When they pay somebody else to cut their hair instead of having a bowl over their own children's head, when they pay somebody else to change their oil for them instead of changing it themselves, mow their lawn for them versus mow the lawn themselves, the quality becomes important, buying based on performance of how the task is performed. Well, with authenticity, the rise of experiences, our definition of authenticity is consumers purchasing based on conformity to self-image. that increasingly it's a personally determined thing, authenticity. You and I could discuss, let's go out for a real Italian meal at a real Italian restaurant and have very different notions about what constitutes real Italian. One might argue that, you know, I might say, let's go to Olive Garden, and you might turn your nose up at that and go, ooh, Olive Garden. You know, let's go down to Little Italy. But if you think about it, the whole notion of Little Italy, the whole notion of an Italian restaurant in America versus in Italy, part of the struggles of the book is philosophically, you have to draw from philosophy, ontologically in its being, it is in fact all man-made. It's all artificial. It's all fake. But some offerings gain the perception of being real. It's why we say that businesses need to control cost, improve quality, and now render authenticity, that there are certain steps that can be taken that help gain the perception of being real, even though, in fact, it is all inauthentic, which is a paradox of sorts.
It is. So how does one render authenticity?
Well, someone once said that frameworks are us. So we have a multiplicity of frameworks and models and business tools to help people sort that exact question out. Let's do a couple of things. We'll have multiple answers to that, really multiple ways to approach the situation. One is to really go back to arguably the source code of the modern day sensibility of authenticity. That is Polonius and Hamlet. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night, the day, thou cannot be false to any man. We see two different components in that quotation. First, the one that's often cited, to thine own self be true. That is that companies and their offerings need to be true to self. That's one dimension. But then you also have thou cannot be false to any man. That is to be what you say you are. So one construct to think about is your company and your company's offering, are they true to self? Do you understand your heritage, your origins, your history, and to draw from that so that you can bring to the marketplace those things that are natural extensions of the corporate self, but also to be what you say you are. And this is where authenticity really, I think, bumps up against contemporary marketing practices. Marketing has been all about messages, making promises, but the problem is that so often the promise of an experience companies fail to deliver against that. And, that's not real. If you say you're one thing, but then you don't live up to that, in actuality, you come off as inauthentic.
Does authenticity map to distinctiveness?
Oh, high correlation. That's a very good insight. But that and more, though. In fact, another model that we have, another framework that we develop, if you take our progression of economic value from commodities to goods to services to experiences and even beyond experiences to transformations as a form of economic output, we detect that there's actually five different genres of authenticity that can be appealed to. And the distinctiveness I would associate with what we call exceptional authenticity, something we relate to services. But there's also natural authenticity, that which you can associate to commodities. That is, some people perceive as authentic that which is natural, untouched by human hands. You know, that's real. And organic whole. Almost all innovation in hand soaps today is all an appeal to natural authenticity, from the ingredients to the appearance to the packaging. There's also original authenticity, originality of design. Almost everything that Apple does today, from the design of the iPod to their Genius Bar in an Apple store, is really an appeal to originality. That can be distinctive, but doing things in an exceptional way is another way of appealing to authenticity. But perhaps most strangely, we've identified this genre of authenticity we call referential authenticity.
Huh.
That is, we live in a time we think when some people perceive as real that which refers to some other person, place, or event in history. And this is where theming comes in today. All theming is inherently referential. And this whole notion came to us when Joe and I committed ourselves to watching a week-long series on the Learning Channel or the Discovery Station, one of those cable television networks, a week-long series on Las Vegas. And we often say that Las Vegas is the epicenter of the experience economy, so we committed to watch the show. And watching the show, the reporters on the street, they do these you know, person on the street interviews, the camera pointed in somebody's face and they stick a microphone before them. And they would ask multiple consumers, what is it that you like about Las Vegas? And repeatedly the answer would come back, well, we like Las Vegas because it's so real. And, you know, first time I heard it, I just shook my head. I mean, you know, what am I hearing? But in fact, a great deal of Las Vegas makes an appeal to authenticity. It's, you know, it's authentically inauthentic, if you will. It's true to self. It's true to Las Vegas. And this can be proved by looking at what doesn't work in Las Vegas. You know, the Aladdin, I take clients in on what I call learning excursions, and I'll take them into the casino entrance of the Aladdin. And universally, the reaction is, as people look around, is they go, well, what's it supposed to be? There's nothing referential about it. Versus those places in Las Vegas that resonate with people, the Venetian, Bellagio, New York, Las Vegas, and so forth. These are places that referentially honor the original location. So it's a very strange postmodern genre of authenticity, one that I've actually been an advocate of calling our book, titling our book Fauthenticity, because that's really what I think it is. It's a strange genre of authenticity. Let's do this. You go back 20 years ago, a term of derision if people did not like something was they say, that's a piece of junk. You don't hear that too much today. Today, if people don't like something, they say, that's so fake. But if they like it, they call it faux. Faux fireplaces, faux fur, I mean, faux Christmas trees. Faux is a high growth, faux represents many high growth industries today because they're become successful at rendering authenticity, taking something that is in fact inauthentic and gaining the perception of it being authentic.
You know, when you say that Las Vegas would be the epicenter of experiences and the experience economy, of course, some of us would recoil at that.
Sure.
And thinking, I want no part of the experience economy, right?
That's some. But for every person who goes to Vegas, somebody else goes on a whitewater rafting trip or ecotourism to Costa Rica. People decide in what categories of experience, much like they decide in what categories of service or goods they want to do something themselves or purchase. Think about the experience economy. There's so many different dimensions and facets to it. But Las Vegas represents a significant segment of it. Let's just take different industries. Let's take restaurants. The ever increasing percentage of meals eaten away from home versus in home versus our ancestors, and you can go to Las Vegas for the practices of restaurants. Increasing Las Vegas charges flat fee for dining, for the dining experience, not charging per entree, which is a food service model, and you'll see that practice exported to elsewhere around the world. Security, there's now security cameras in taxi cabs. You're on video. That will be exported elsewhere. So from restaurants to the mundane world of security cameras, the whole sensory phenomena, the use of the screen in Las Vegas is being exported. One of the ways to bring to life our progression of economic value from commodities to goods to services to experiences is with birthdays. If when I was a little boy, you know, my mom made my birthday cake from scratch. She made my cake from actual commodities, you know, 10 or 20 cents worth of stuff. But then in the 80s, she would go to the grocery store and buy a cake mix, make the cake from a physical good. Then in the 90s, moms really stopped making a cake from the physical good. They would instead call the grocery store or call the local bakery, have a cake made on their behalf. That's a cake-making service. And in the 90s, of course, parents outsourced the entire birthday party, you know, to a Chuck E. Cheese. And you know, to me, Chuck E. Cheese is a wonderful icon for Las Vegas coming to your town. People don't pause to think about little kids walking around with tokens in plastic cups, how Vegas-like that is. Or ESPN zones, which are modeled after sports books in Las Vegas casinos. Or Hooters. There's now like over 100 Hooters, which is very much the costuming of cocktail waitresses in Las Vegas. I could go on and on and on about different segments of the economy that if you sort of can divorce from the accoutrements of the Vegas version of it, you know, exists in a local pottery studio charging for a birthday party to the, you know, gymnastics class, to the soccer camps and so forth and so on. So in that sense, we talk about Las Vegas being the epicenter.
CEOs for Cities did a study recently, Jim, with urban leaders, and the ingredient for successful cities they cited most often, surprisingly, was vibrancy. That ranked higher than schools. It ranked higher than economic development. How does vibrancy relate to this concept of authenticity or experiences?
Well, I love the word, and I have not heard it put forward that. I think they're onto something. It's whoever uncovered that, I think, has detected something. Yeah, what I like about it is vibrancy is a word that I think is more attached to authenticity and not one that's attached to quality. I mean, for years, for decades, you hear about cities that was about the quality of life. And it's not, you know, I think as Richard Florida has done a great job of writing about in his book, The Creative Class, that it's not about the quality of life. It's about the authenticity of living in the city. I think vibrancy is associated with that. But I would in drawing from our work, I would say there's multiple components that contribute to gaining this sense of vibrancy. That I might point to one of our frameworks in the experience economy, that it takes both entertainment, which is we normally associate with Vegas, but more than that, it takes educational experiences, escapist experiences, a sense of escape, and also just aesthetics, the aesthetic of just hanging out and being. So I think I very much would attach the word vibrancy to experiences. You don't talk about so much about vibrant services or vibrant goods or vibrant commodities, you know, vibrant experiences. And with that, I think a sense of authenticity as well.
You challenged organizations in your book to name a chief experience officer to make sure that enough attention is given to experiences. Interestingly, in the study I just mentioned, the two other ingredients of successful cities named just after vibrancy were education and economic development. And in most cities, you can name the chief education officer. You can usually identify the chief economic development officer, but there's no one in charge of vibrancy, or for that matter, your idea of authenticity.
Yeah, the title almost doesn't matter. I mean, whether it's chief experience officer or chief vibrancy officer, the notion is somebody needs to be put in charge of it. You know, three things have happened. Three broad directions of activity have emerged since the writing of our book, The Experience Economy. One is what's called experiential marketing, which is to take this body of thought and make marketing more experiential. That's very worthwhile, but that's not new output. That in and of itself, I don't think leads to vibrancy. The second has actually now been called customer experience management. It even has an acronym, CEM, which I find amusing, which is the notion of making operations more experiential. But the real thrust of our work is that, say, experiences are a new form of economic output, that there are experience offerings, that one can have an experience business. And I think, indeed, for cities, in addition to somebody who is responsible for overseeing the education of children and adults in their city, and for economic development, that similarly somebody I actually think that it's almost the whoever's in charge of economic development actually could also wear this hat, that they could increasingly view economic development in terms of experiences. But when we wrote that, which actually was after the publication of the book, the notion was don't just let current functions and current departments become more experiential, but put somebody in charge explicitly of experiences themselves.
Jim, it was a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you for having me.
James Gilmore is co-author of The Experience Economy and partner in Strategic Horizons. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on authenticity and real places with Scott Russell Sanders. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Scott Russell Sanders is Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University. He is the author of more than 20 books, including novels, collections of short stories, and personal nonfiction. His latest book, published this spring, is A Private History of Awe, which is a coming-of-age memoir, love story, and spiritual testament. Scott, you've written what's being sold to us every day as the American way of life is mostly a cheat and a lie. It's an infantile dream of endless consumption, endless novelty, and endless play. It's a pacifier for the ego to suck on. Where do you find evidence of that? Give me examples.
Well, if you think about how advertising treats the person who's sitting on the couch or driving by the billboard, it treats the consumer, and what an appalling name that is, isn't it? Consumer, it treats the consumer as the center of the universe. One's own comfort, pleasure, convenience, status, and style is what the universe is devoted to serving. That's very flattering. It just happens to be utterly false. The universe is not concerned with our comfort, our status, our pleasure. The people having things to sell us are the ones who are concerned with it. So I think advertising is the key place where that lie is being told, the lie that the meaning of life, the purpose of life is to buy things and consume things.
Do you think it's fair, Scott, to criticize advertisers who, after all, have a product to sell? They have an incentive to do this. Or is it simply the absence of countervailing messages?
Well, the global budget for advertising is something over $1 trillion. And the countervailing voices, whether it's the local school board trying to engage parents in a concern for the quality of their schools, or peace groups or social justice groups, the countervailing voices have to hold bake sales to fund themselves. There's nothing evil about advertising. It's just that it has such an enormous force of money and vested concerns behind it that it swamps everything else. One can't go almost anywhere in America today outside the walls of one's own house, without encountering the messages of advertisers. And yet we very rarely encounter messages that urge us to look after other people, to take care of our homes, to take care of our communities, to look after our parks and schools and so forth. So it's just a disproportionate emphasis on consumption that advertising imposes on us that I think has warped our vision of what the meaning of life is.
Well, I have to agree with you, and yet I can't think of a solution. Can you?
Well, the only way of restraining the impact of advertising is for citizens to resist it. For example, I think it's an outrage that the public landscape is devoted to billboards. It's as though we had turned over some portion of our physical space to people who want to sell us things. Why should we do that? Why should we have to drive in and out of our cities, in and out of our neighborhoods or along our highways and stare at commercial messages? Why can't we see the landscape? I think citizens and also their elected representatives in communities can place some boundaries on where commercial messages can intrude. We have advertising in many of our schools now by a Clear Channel. We have advertising on radio in school buses in many places. We don't need to allow that. We need there to be spaces that are advertising free where people can decide for themselves without advertising's blandishments, can decide for themselves what their lives should mean and what would give happiness and satisfaction in their lives.
You have called for a new vision of the good life, a dream worthy of grown-ups, you called
it. Yes.
What would that vision look like?
I think the first element of a grown-up vision is a sense of responsibility to others, a sense of responsibility to people outside oneself and even outside one's own family. I think some extraordinarily selfish people can care about their families, but they often that's where their sense of responsibility stops. That's a kind of adolescent approach to life, the sense that one's own pleasure and status and satisfaction, or at most one's family's pleasure and prosperity, are all that matter. That's the way an adolescent sees the world. Adolescents notoriously regard the universe as circling around their own needs and their own moods. A grown-up is someone who has taken on responsibility to other people. It might be the patients that a doctor has. It might be the clients that a lawyer has. It might be the students that a teacher has, or simply the children that parents have. But to feel a sense of responsibility for the well-being of other human beings and also for the welfare of our communities, I think that's a key to being a grown-up.
You are a professor at Indiana University. Do you talk to your students about this idea? And I'm curious what their reaction is.
Well, one of the things I ask my students is what they see as their goal in life. What is it that they want out of life? Reminding them that, of course, life is surprisingly brief. How do they want to spend it? And often their first answer will be, well, I want to get a good job and I want to earn a lot of money and have a nice place to live. And I say, well, there's nothing wrong with that, but do you think that is going to be fulfilling? Sometimes they do. Sometimes they say, yeah, if I can buy whatever I want and live in a nice house and drive a nice car and wear nice clothes, life will be great. Well, I think they're wrong. I think they will find out that that is not enough to give them happiness and meaning in life, but they're free to decide that or figure that out, find that out on their own. But more thoughtful students will say, well, I would like to do something in life that allows me to use my creativity and my intelligence, allows me to do something useful in the world, and something I can feel proud of, and something that entails more than just making money or buying things. I think a lot of young people want to do something useful and meaningful in their lives beyond what commercial marketplace America offers them.
You talked about a new vision being a sense of responsibility, but beyond yourself, beyond your family, to include others, to include community. And you also talked, Scott, about the overwhelming amount of messages that urge us to consume. How do you think an alternative vision of the good life gets started? Who tells that story? How does it gain momentum?
Well, first of all, many, many people tell parts or aspects or versions of the story. It's not something that's going to emanate from, certainly from me or from any small number of people. It's going to arise in the hearts and minds of people who are involved in cooperative and compassionate efforts in their own places. So, for example, people working on a Habitat for Humanity project, or people organizing a food co-op, or people organizing a farmer's market, or an after-school basketball league, on and on. People who are actually doing the work of creating community and enriching the lives of their neighbors understand intuitively where the meaning in their life comes from. And they become ambassadors for that vision. They may say it openly. They may give talks at local community groups or in their churches or synagogues or mosques, or they might just tell their neighbors. Or they simply may exhibit that way of living in their daily life and be an example to other people. They're not going to make it on the evening news. They're not going to make headlines in the local newspaper even, because the work they're doing is not contributing to a kind of commercial vision of life or consumer vision of life. So I think in fact there are, I was going to say thousands, I would say millions of people in the United States alone who are actively involved every day in working towards a society that is more peaceful, simpler in its material tastes and habits, more sustainable and more compassionate.
One of your books is titled Staying Put, and yet we don't stay put. We travel more than ever. Is there a way to make travel more benign or, best case, more rewarding to travelers and the places they visit?
I think that Americans are perhaps the most nomadic, most mobile people in the history of the planet, although humans have always been wanderers. Some kinds of journeying can be deeply nourishing. I certainly have traveled a lot in my life. I'm grateful for that. I've learned from it. And I know that encountering other places and other ways of life can be illuminating and deeply instructive. So I'm not against people moving around. What I am for is people looking for a place to which they can commit themselves. It might, in some instances, be a place where they were born and grew up. But more often, for most of us, and this is true in my case, the place we come to in our adult life, perhaps because of marriage or because of education or because of work, the place we come to in our adult life where we feel we can invest ourselves, can put down roots, can learn a place in depth. That, it seems to me, is a worthy goal, and that's the theme of Staying Put. In terms of the more casual kind of movement, not moving from place to place for a job or not moving from place to place to settle in a new home, but simply to visit another place, it seems to me the most valuable kind of tourism, if you will, is that which teaches the traveler something that he or she can bring back and invest in their own community. It's not just recreation. It's not just one passing one's own time in a pleasurable way. That seems to me shallow. It's more a matter of perceiving something, recognizing something, learning something that one can then bring back and use to the benefit of one's own community. It might have something to do with architecture. It might have something to do with interior design. It might have something to do with gardening or with cuisine or with art. But to bring that back to your home place and enrich your home place as a benefit of what you've learned when you've gone elsewhere. A great deal of tourism in America is simply an effort to avoid boredom. It's a kind of hunting for a new sensation because the sensations one is familiar with have palled, have lost their edge. I think that is a recipe not only for frustration and sustained boredom on the part of the traveler, but it's also a recipe for ecological and communal devastation. Communities can be torn apart if they simply become a service industry for people who casually come through. Similarly, the price that the planet pays in terms of petroleum burned and greenhouse gases released and air pollution and so forth, the price that the planet pays and therefore the future generations pay for our travel is enormous. So if we're going to travel, it had better be for worthwhile purposes.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Scott Russell Sanders. He's a distinguished professor of English at Indiana University and author of more than 20 books, the most recent of which is A Private History of Awe. One of the problems with travel, Scott, is that increasingly our cities look the same. The way you put it is that our towns and cities feel like jumbles rather than communities. Why?
I think one reason is the impact of franchises. The impulse behind a national or more often a global franchise is for things to be the same, so that you can go into a given franchise in Hong Kong or in Buenos Aires or in Indianapolis, and it will look the same, it will feel the same, the service will be the same. There's obviously a comfort in that. If there weren't a comfort in that, it wouldn't be patronized. At the same time, there's something appallingly dull about that and unimaginative about that. A restaurant or a hotel or a clothing store should not be the same in Hong Kong or Buenos Aires and Indianapolis because those are such dramatically different and interestingly different places. So I think franchises and the impact of global corporations are the main reason for this homogenizing of our towns and cities. Another reason, I think, is that our towns and cities, instead of looking to their own history, what's distinctive about their own past, their own population, their own landscape, instead of looking to themselves and their own distinctive qualities, look elsewhere and try to see what other towns or other cities have done. And so they go around like copycats often, reproducing what has seemed striking or effective elsewhere, instead of trying to imagine and discern what would be distinctive and valuable in their own place.
I could not agree with you more. You've actually hit a real hot button with me, Scott, on looking, instead of looking to themselves, cities look to other places and copy best practices. And it seems it certainly is serving, as you say, to move us towards sameness. What's the problem here? Is it that the leadership is simply timid? What causes a city to do such an inane thing?
Well, I won't pretend to know what happens in any given instance, of course, but I have some hunches. One hunch is that too narrow a stratum of the whole city's population is involved in the decision-making. If a wider spectrum of citizens, rich, poor, different ethnicities, different professions, etc., if a wider spectrum of a city's citizens were involved in talking about what the city needs, the ideas would be more varied, they would be richer, and they would have more to do with the place. If, for example, visual artists from a city, or poets from a city, or ministers from a city were involved, if people who work on the streets, people who garden, people who raise food in or near a city, if they were involved in the conversation about what a city needs, the ideas would be more varied, and I think they would be more distinctive to the place.
You've thought about, we were talking earlier about distinctiveness, and I know you've thought about the qualities that give certain places a distinctive character. Talk about those qualities, Scott.
It can be everything from food to the smell of a river to the birds that pass through backyard gardens. It certainly includes domestic architecture, houses, apartments, and so forth. It certainly includes commercial architecture. It can, public architecture, such as city or municipal buildings. It includes museums. It includes accents, regional accents. It includes religious denominations that are characteristic of a place. It includes an awareness of history, of how a given city or a given community was first settled, who lived there before, say, European settlers came, the way in which the city has grown over the years with different immigrant groups coming in, perhaps. An awareness of human history and also an awareness of natural history. What are the trees native to this place? What are the wildflowers that grow in the woods? What's the weather like? What does the air feel like? What does the water taste like? An awareness of the natural history of a place and of the human history of the place are profoundly important to a sense of place. And a sense of place is our primary antidote to the homogenizing of culture that I spoke about earlier. I think that a sense of place is what gives us, as citizens of any community, a deepest feeling of belonging, a deepest feeling of being in a good place, a place that we share with human and non-human neighbors.
Scott, you've listed a number of characteristics that give certain places distinctiveness. Would you recommend that cities catalog these distinctive assets and then look at how they can be capitalized on, how they can be embellished, made more amplified, I guess, if you will, and made more present not only to visitors, but more importantly to residents themselves?
What I encourage communities to do is to take an inventory of what the people who live there love about the place. We hear everybody has complaints about where they live. It could be the most marvelous place on earth, and we're, humans are going to complain about certain aspects of it. And that's only to be expected. On the other hand, people who live somewhere that they care about, where they that they feel an affection for, if you ask them, what do you love? What are your special places in this city? Let's get a map here and put it on the wall, and you write on it where maybe the place where you and the woman you ended up marrying first took a walk, or maybe the place where your dad used to take you for an ice cream when you were a little girl, or maybe a place where you like to take a walk with your dog. Write on this map here and show us the places that are special to you. And let's get lots of people to come in and write on this map. And what you find is that there are these overlapping points of affection, places that are significant, places that may not seem any big deal, like a coffee shop or the farmer's market or even a gas station on the corner. They may not seem like any big deal, and yet to a lot of people who live there, they're actually centers of meaning and importance. They're places where they interact with their neighbors, where they see the kids of the neighborhood, or they hear from the old stories from the old-timers. So take an inventory of what it is, places, institutions, festivals, activities, what it is in the community that the people who live there actually love and value.
Scott, what a pleasure it was to talk with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
It's been a great pleasure for me as well, Carol. Thank you.
Scott Russell Sanders is Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says diversity fuels energy and excitement and defines the cultural landscape of America today.
Difference is the most common thing in America nowadays. No matter where you look, what you see is a dazzling kaleidoscope of difference and diversity. Look at household structure. For the first time in U.S. history, the so-called traditional family, a married couple with kids at home, comprises less than 25% of U.S. households. Non-family households are almost one-third of the total, a 50% increase since 1970. Multi-generational households, with three or more generations of parents and children living together, now make up 4% of U.S. households. Or look at race and ethnicity. Minorities like Hispanics, African Americans, Native Americans, Asians, and others grew 43% from 1990 to 2000, not to mention the 2.4% who checked more than one box for race in the last census. Hispanics alone grew 58% over that decade and now constitute 13% of the U.S. population. This burgeoning of Hispanics is doubly important, because Hispanics are a highly diverse group of Mexicans, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorans, Dominicans, Ecuadorans, and many others who bring with them diverse cross-national experiences because of the immigration that is such an important driver of Hispanic population growth. Or look at popular culture. The number of pop music genres is substantial and growing, many of which, like swing music and jam bands, reprise old styles instead of introducing something brand new. Musicians sample and fuse funk and punk, country and rap, hip-hop and electropop. Fusion foods show up on every menu. Miss America contestants sport piercings and tattoos. Long hairs, short hairs, shaved heads, mohawks, spikes, buzz cuts, and beehives can all be found in the same high school cafeteria on any given day, or in the same office building or shopping center. Anything ever written, filmed, invented, or produced is accessible online or on TV. People feel permission to be different. The result is a staggering diversity of styles, forms, fashions, and innovations. And not just diversity, but a jumble of diversity. Not a checkerboard, but a collage. a new diversity perhaps best characterized as Kablan Asian, the term Tiger Woods used to answer Oprah's question about his ethnicity when he appeared on her show after his first Masters victory. Kablan Asian is a syllable or two from Caucasian, Black, American Indian, and Asian, all of which are in Tiger's heritage. The background of life today is exactly this mix-and-match sort of diversity in which everything is blended with everything else to produce a cornucopia of things that are totally new and often unexpected. This is the central challenge facing communities as they face up to tomorrow: building unity by celebrating difference, not by quashing it. In the midst of this new diversity, communities must find ways to come together. The defensive reaction is to separate and pull apart into separate pods. But the smart reaction is to learn from others and to appropriate those elements that can improve what you value the most. As a matter of fact, this sort of borrowing is increasingly common, for this new style of Kablan Asian diversity is largely the product of individual self-invention. Feeling newly energized and empowered, people are no longer content to simply consume what's offered. Instead, people are actively creating new styles for themselves. This energy and enthusiasm is the power that communities must harness. Communities must engage the fervor and resolve arising from diversity and difference, and then use it to build stronger common bonds. Bonds that are rooted in a common respect for difference. Indeed, without a commitment to difference and diversity, communities will be left behind. Because the new diversity is in constant motion, difference begets more difference, new styles age faster, and fashions at the fringes grow ever further apart. Young people in particular, having come of age in a time of surfing and sampling, are accelerating this new diversity to an explosive velocity. What will be different about tomorrow is difference itself. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose new report on America's portal neighborhoods can be found at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.